All right, the time is now 11:01. We will begin the public meeting of the District of Columbia Board of Ethics and Government Accountability.
All right, I'm going to call this meeting to order. We do have a quorum here. We have three of the four board members. I am Tamika Collier. We have Norma Hutchins and Shamari Wade. We'll now turn to the adoption of the agenda. Board members, if you have no comments or changes to the agenda, I will entertain a motion.
I move to adopt the agenda.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Great. We will start by the report from the Director of Open Government.
Thank you. Good morning. The Office of Open Government conducted two Open Meetings Act trainings since the last board meeting. One of the trainings was a MOTA combined training, and the second training was a training for the members of the State Board of Education. The Yates matter, unfortunately, has been continued yet again until September 15th, so there are no updates on that particular matter. We handled 31 FOIA advice requests in the last month and fielded 6 Open Meetings Act advice requests, and 2 of those were for technical assistance. Additionally, the Office of Open Government issued 1 FOIA opinion, and that's OOG-0005, regarding whether the Office of the Inspector General may rely on FOIA statutory exemptions to withhold content from a report on investigation when a permanent copy of the report had been released into the public domain. We resolved 2 Open Meetings Act complaints. The first, 0002, the date of that was June 28, 17, when we received it, and that was a complaint resolving whether the New Communities Initiative is a public body subject to the requirements of the Open Meetings Act, and OOG-0004, whether the DC Public Charter School Board may rely on Robert's Rules of Order to revise at its meeting a final agenda to consider items which require public notice, public presence, and a period of public comment. And that completes the update of the Office of Open Government for the past 30 days.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Mr. Flowers.
Morning, Madam Chair and members of the board. The first item for me to go over would be our update on the status of our statistics. As you see, we opened 4 investigations and we closed 11. We have 16 currently open and 17 inactive. I'll explain a little bit later how we arrived at these numbers, because you see that the 11 that were closed, some of those were inactive, so they didn't count against the number of open cases. So moving down to the inactive cases, and we tried to look at these cases very closely to determine whether or not they should remain in that status, and you'll see how this breaks down, and we'll discuss some of these cases in a little more detail just to let the board know what we've been doing since the last meeting in terms of trying to bring closure to some of these cases. Publication and reporting obligations, we have no outstanding obligations, but as required by the Ethics Act, we published a summary of registered lobbyists registrations for the 2017 filing year in the DC Register on August 11, and we're currently reviewing our CBE commitments for the upcoming fiscal year. Training and outreach attended by staff, only 1, Attorney Stuart Mitchell, attended a course offered by the DC Bar entitled More Effective Writing Makes More Effective Lawyers. This is something we tried to do, is to ensure that all the attorneys take writing courses, because it's just an important part of what we do. You'll see a little bit later in terms of staffing, we're trying to bring on some staff that will be able to help some of the cases that we want to, we just need more effective writing in our office. Secondly, I've been invited to serve on a working group that is tasked with modernizing the district's rulemaking procedures. I previously worked in this area for 10 years, and I served on a Model State Administrative Procedure Act committee. And I also have presented to the DC Bar and the DC APA. I don't anticipate that work will detract from what we do at BEGA, and I think it will help, actually. Honestly, I don't anticipate any major changes in the district's APA. I mean, it's been 30 years, and that's one thing that we encountered when the Model Act was adopted, was that states were very reticent to make any changes to their APAs.
What is causing this activity now, this interest in changing policymaking procedures?
Well, what drove the 2010 revision was the onset of basically electronic rulemaking and just the modern information age, trying to update the APAs to accommodate that. I'm not sure what the focus is going to be for us, because ours is a very abbreviated APA. We don't have many requirements at all. I mean, in terms of rulemaking with federal government, you got to justify any change in your rule with a basis and purpose statement. We don't have to do that. We don't really even have to address comments that we receive. So that may be an area that's focused, that's where there's a focus. And with the 2010 revision, there was also a lot of debate on ex parte communications, just in contested case hearings and in rulemaking proceedings. I don't know if that's going to be a focus of this working group either, but most of those concerns were raised by people outside of government. And they didn't even want, for example, the staff of a tribunal to communicate with the chair ex parte. This would mean Mr. Grimaldi would not be able to communicate with you ex parte during the pendency of a proceeding.
All right. Okay.
Let's see. Conducted by staff, we conducted 12 different types of training in the last month. And as usual, we had 3 new employee orientations and MSS trainings, 1 general board and commission training, 1 regular monthly ethics training, and a training session at the Criminal Justice Coordinating Council and the DC Code Reform Commission. And we also conducted 2 local Hatch Act trainings for EOM staff, which included several agency heads. I believe there are 2 more of these Hatch Act trainings that are going to be done within the next couple of weeks. I mean, obviously, it's a political season, so this is a very relevant training. So we'll be doing that, and as well as we'll have that on Ethics Day, which is the next item for discussion.
Let the record reflect that we are now joined by Carol Schwartz.
Thank you.
Brian, who's conducting these trainings? Are you doing all of them yourself?
No. Ashley Cooks has done the last 2 Hatch Act trainings. She's our training coordinator.
Okay.
There's 1 coming up with the city administrator. I'll be doing that one, but Ms. Cooks is certainly well qualified to do that as well.
Okay.
So Ethics Day is scheduled to take place on October 19th following the monthly board meeting. We've secured the participation of the Office of Partnerships and Grant Services, OIG, Office of Campaign Finance, DC Counsel's Office of General Counsel, and the DC Bar has agreed to co-sponsor and conduct a legal ethics course for government attorneys. We will offer a total of 9 ethics courses. For some reason, we don't have OOG listed, but OOG will be participating as well.
Has the agenda changed from the one that you presented at the last board meeting?
No.
No.
It's the same agenda.
Okay. Board members, refresh my memory. We voted on that. Did we also, in that vote, also vote to move the October meeting to October 19th?
I think we did. My recollection is we did.
Okay.
We certainly discussed it.
It's not my recollection that there was a vote. It was discussed.
Okay.
The discussion was that it would be taken up at this meeting.
Okay. Then I will entertain a motion now for us to move the October public meeting to October 19th. Beginning at 11. Is that the date on the agenda? 11 a.m.
I believe it is, yes.
That would be our board meeting?
Our board meeting, the public meeting.
A summit. Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, the other item under... yes.
Can we have a clarification, though, about the agenda? Do we know the upshot of... the settlement agreement that was made before any of us arrived?
Not a part of Ethics Day.
not a part of it?
No, absolutely not.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Okay.
Miss Ethics video. So we've been working with the production company, the same one that produced the Miss Ethics video that many of you may have seen, to create 6 short ethics videos, sort of snippets that are specific to ethics subject matters. Each video will be 30 seconds long, and each scene will feature an actor calling Miss Ethics over the telephone for advice. The actual shoot for the video is scheduled to take place on September 15th. And will be completed at the beginning of October, and our goal is to show these videos as a part of the Ethics Day program. Again, we are calling on our employees to volunteer and participate in the production. There will be the one paid actress, who is Miss Ethics, and that should be it. Advisory opinions and formal advice, 65 since the last meeting, slightly up from 59 last month. Formal advice requests have been pretty active. Since the last meeting, we received 5 requests for formal opinions. We published one of these formal advisory opinions on whether certain activities undertaken by the district government to encourage residents to contact United States senators regarding district statehood would violate the code of conduct. We concluded that the EOM and the Statehood Commission could, through OCTO, develop and create a portal that would facilitate district residents' communications with U.S. senators. That opinion is in your Dropbox. If there are any questions, we'd certainly be happy to respond. So during that time period, we also received 4 requests for opinions on the application of post-employment rules, one of which has since been withdrawn. The one that was withdrawn, it was also sort of caught up with an investigation. So sometimes when persons know that there's a complaint filed against them, then they will ask for an opinion, and we have to decide how to handle that, since it's really the investigation has already been initiated, so it's too late. They really sort of are in the posture of asking for forgiveness at that point. And so that's one less advice, and the person did come in, counsel them. We're trying to determine how the investigation is going to proceed at this point. So one of those post-employment requests also came from former council member Vincent Orange, who followed up with more questions based on the advice he was given earlier last month. His latest request and the draft response are in the Dropbox, and I'll let Mr. Grimaldi take it from here.
Thank you, Mr. Flowers.
Yeah, it's on.
Okay.
Board members, if you'll recall, we responded to Mr. Orange in a letter that's posted on the website dated August 3rd. He had followed up on some of the advice that was given to him in September of last year, 2016. He followed up again with a letter dated August 7, seeking some clarification on what we'd said in August. And the draft letter that's in the Dropbox addresses that request for clarification. But as significant, he raised the possibility anyway of running in the district's 2018 elections and wanted to know, within the context of conflicts of interest and appearances of conflicts, if there was going to be some problem with that. So the letter is addressed to that question. I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have or any changes that you suggest we make to the letter. And then once it's finalized and signed by the chair, of course, we will also post it on the website.
And just for further clarification, the chair signed the initial opinion letter because of the high public interest and visibility of the issue, signifying that the board and the office was speaking as one on this. And so I continued to sign the follow-ups related to the initial letter. But as a general rule, it is the director not the board who makes the initial response to request for formal opinions. But that's the only reason why I have continued to sign on behalf of the board.
Any questions, suggestions for changes to the response? Okay.
Thank you.
Again, this will be posted on the website probably no later than tomorrow.
On the topic of ethics legislation and the Comprehensive Code of Conduct, along with Chairperson Collier and Mr. Grimaldi, I met with Councilmember Charles Allen and his committee director on August 29 to discuss the CCC. I believe we all thought the meeting went well. The council member had reviewed a copy of the PowerPoint that we used during meetings last council period on the lapse bill, and he asked a number of questions as we went through the presentation. We also received confirmation after the meeting that the second hearing on the CCC will be held during the morning of November 2nd. And I believe that may conflict with our scheduled board meeting. Between now and then, we will also be meeting with the Mayor's General Counsel and the Director of OPLA, as well as each member of the Judiciary Committee to try to move this legislation forward. And I will recognize again Mr. Grimaldi to address the current proposal to increase the board's quorum requirement.
Thank you, Mr. Flowers. As the board's aware, when the council increased the size of the board from 3 members to 5 members, it did not, probably through oversight, increase the quorum requirement for the board, which has and has always been 2. We raised some policy considerations in various best practices reports over the years. For example, we had been looking at the time to have hearing panels. At the time, we wanted to increase the size of the board of 3 members. That was one of the reasons we were advocating the increase in size of the board, and we thought at the same time they would go ahead and increase the quorum requirement as well. But evidently, through oversight, they didn't. I've looked through the relevant committee reports and didn't see any explanation to give any kind of reason that they purposely didn't do it. So what we think is appropriate at this point, or what I'm suggesting the board consider certainly, is go to the council and request through legislation an increase in the quorum requirement from 2 to 3 members. So in the Dropbox, you have a legislative package that includes an emergency bill, an accompanying emergency declaration resolution, and a temporary bill. If the board sees fit, what I propose is that I contact Councilmember Allen's office. Again, he's the chair of our Oversight Commission, and discuss the legislation with him, or certainly with his staff, and see if he wants to put it forward. I think the council comes back from recess on the 15th of this month. Their first legislative meeting is the 19th. Or, of course, as you know, we could go through the chair as an independent agency. We could go through the chair if he, for whatever reason, doesn't want to sponsor the legislation himself. So the emergency deck sets out some of the reasons we think the quorum requirement should be increased, including a concern that even when 2 of you get together informally to discuss any public business before the board, it arguably is a meeting within the definition of the Open Meetings Act. So for practical reasons and certainly for legal reasons, given the OMA, we're thinking it would be a wise thing for the council to do to increase the quorum requirement from 2 to 3 members.
Madam Chair.
Sure.
I
I think it's a good idea. We're supposed to be a five-person body. We're only four. But still, two is not really a majority of us. So I think in everybody, any kind of venue I've ever served in, you always have above of the what a simple group would be. And so three out of five, two out of three, that kind of setup. So I think this is a good idea. I never knew that wasn't the case in the law, but I'm sure it was just, as you said, an oversight in just getting it passed. Either you didn't put it in your legislation or they didn't think to put it in theirs, and so it didn't happen. It's nobody's fault. But I think it's good we're rectifying it. When I read the legislation, though, as proposed, we referred to ourselves as Ethics Board a couple of times, and then we go on further down and say the Board of Ethics and Government Accountability. I did not particularly like being called the Ethics Board, as it was at one part. I don't have the legislation in front of me. So I think I would go ahead and say the Board of Ethics and Government Accountability, then repeat it again. Instead of, a lot of people would look at, what's the Ethics Board? I mean, we're not known as the Ethics Board. We're known as the Board of Ethics and Government Accountability. And then, you know, in the old days of the board, it was the Board of Elections and Ethics. We know that's been changed, but still a lot of people think of it too as the Board of Elections and Ethics, since it had that title for many, many years. So to order not to have any kind of confusion, I would just, in the, both the temporary, the emergency, and the underlying legislation, I would spell out our names completely.
Right. And just point well taken, I'll make those revisions. The reason the legislative package did not include a permanent bill, is especially if Councilmember Allen is okay with this plan, given dependency of the CCC, we would put the permanent provision, the substantively identical permanent provision, in the CCC, which, among other things, aside from establishing the comprehensive code itself, will make other amendments to the Ethics Act.
Okay. Ms. Schwartz's point, let's make sure that the language we use is consistent with the language that's already in the Ethics Act. If I understand what we're doing, we're just replacing certain sentences. So I think the term Ethics Board is actually used throughout the Ethics Act.
It is. Yeah, I'm going to go back and double check, though.
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
I wasn't aware of that, but I think if it isn't, we want to do this differently.
I'll double check.
If it's just a substitution of something that's already done, then leaving it that way would be fine with me.
Okay.
Do you want a motion?
Do we need a motion?
I don't know that.
Is there any further discussion on it?
Yeah.
None.
Okay.
Fine.
Thank you.
The board is adopting or recommending that the legislation go forward, right? Has that
Correct.
Been done?
Do we need a motion to?
You could do it, sure. Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Rulemaking. We've included in your Dropbox a proposed rulemaking that makes changes to ensure the board's rules are consistent with the Council Financial Disclosure Amendment Act of 2016. That requires the chairman and each member of the council to file a public financial disclosure statement semi-annually on May 15 and November 15. I believe it's really just a technical and clarifying type of change, because the legislation already requires it, but we just want to make sure that our rules were consistent with the law. I did not include anything such as members have to be given notice 30 days in advance or 6 weeks in advance, and all of that sort of thing, because there are only the 15 members, and the general counsel's office at the council is going to be, they're going to be coordinating with us on this. And they're, again, from May 15, we've not had any issues with council members, and I don't think we will with November 15th either. So it's basically just a change that reflects what is in the statute. We didn't go beyond that. And you have, Mr. Grimaldi has it. If you agree, then we need to adopt it so that we can amend our rules.
All right, I'll entertain a motion to adopt the rulemaking as proposed by Mr. Flowers.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right.
Okay, we have one other rulemaking issue, but we're not asking the board to act on this one today. The board has the authority to designate additional boards and commissions that would be required to file public financial disclosure statements. Attorney Janet Foster has gone through all of the boards and commissions, and she's highlighted which ones we feel you should focus on in terms of deciding whether or not to require these individuals to file public financial disclosure statements. It's quite a bit of material, so I think you probably need time to digest it.
Yes.
And we want to take it up, I would say at the next meeting, but the next meeting might not be the best time, so it probably would be in November. And at that time, we'll have more specific recommendations. And one thing to note is that the previous Campaign Finance Act had a longer list of boards and commissions that were required to file these public financial disclosure statements. We also have some that we've included in the CCC, but this is something that the board can do by rulemaking if you determine that members of these boards should be filing public financial disclosure statements.
And have you discussed this list with the Office of Campaign Finance?
No, we probably would want to discuss with MOTA as well.
Right. Okay.
Not yet, no.
Okay.
That's a good point. So we'll share it with them.
Also, Ed, it would be helpful once the list is established and finalized, if you could let us know, and then we can put some type of language on the central calendar.
Okay. I think the list was generated from your website.
No, which boards are required to file.
I understand.
Yes.
Okay.
But that's good. I'm glad you used the list.
On terms of the budget, we're closing out fiscal year 17, and we are continuing to have monthly budget meetings. Related to the budget is staffing. We have two new administrative positions to fill in October, as well as the director vacancy.
Did you ever hire a temp?
We did not, no. And for that, we are actually, I think we're going to propose that one of those positions be a paralegal, and one would support the FDS and lobbyist function. But I mean, obviously, you'll have that before it's done, since you are the budget authority. Lobbyist financial disclosure matters. So we're still working to ensure that all non-compliant public financial disclosure statement filers file their forms via our online filing system. Right now, we're counting about 235 non-filers. Approximately 200 of those no longer work with the district government. So we are focused on the 35. And you see how, the 34 actually, because one of them was deleted by an ethics officer. So you see how this breaks down. 11 of those 35 have filed, 15 have been fined and still have not filed since being fined. We have two pending waivers. These are the cases that are pending in court. And we have six pending statuses, three persons with no email addresses, and for three others, we're still waiting for an update from the ethics officers. Current year confidential financial disclosure statement enforcement, we are currently reviewing CFDS reports and following up, so we don't have any concrete proposals for this year's CFDS filers, because they're really still at the agency at this point.
So for those 15 that have been fined and still have not filed, but we know they are current district employees, what measures are we taking to notify the ethics office officers? I believe for the last year's list. We even reached out to EOM. Rather than waiting another year when we're ready for NOVs, should we now start reaching out to anyone that has any type of authority or oversight over these 15 individuals to try to get them in compliance sooner rather than later?
Absolutely, yes. Hold on, this is Stuart Mitchell. Speak to the effort that we're making.
Yes. Good morning, Board, Madam Chair. So, yes, that is definitely a part of, it's going to be a part of our notification and then enforcement actions. We're going to start notifying supervisors and anybody that we think could help us get these folks into compliance. For these particular people, we sent out two notifications to them between May 15th and the present, and then when we realized they were not responding, we went ahead and sent out the fine letter. So next steps would be to let higher-ups know that they've been fined. Can you get them to file? And then we'll move on to garnishment to get the $300 fine.
Okay. But you'll, if you'll move on to garnishment if they file. If they haven't, if they do not file, then it's an NOV, and we'll take care of the money in the NOV.
Right.
Okay.
I believe we're going to do both. If they have a file, there's going to be a garnishment if they're current employee.
Why use the resources to go through the garnishment process and the NOV process?
The garnishment process is a memo to OPRS.
So for the four NOVs that you're presenting today, have they already been garnished? I believe
they should have.
We're in the process. We haven't sent the memos. We have them all ready to go.
Okay.
Yeah. But that is the plan.
Okay.
To garnish in addition to the NOV. And there'll be an investigation also as to why they didn't file, because I don't want to say you're presumed guilty, but it just baffles me why some people won't file, and then when they file, they report nothing. It's very suspicious.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I just want to say your question and the response that we got from staff is great. I think that the sooner we start working on these, the better, instead of having them all kind of pile up at the end. And then it gets confusing about which time they didn't file and all. I think it's excellent. And I just want to commend you for it.
I guess my question is, what happens if they still don't file? Are they allowed to remain in their jobs? And the job that requires them to file.
Well, we certainly can't remove them, but that's one reason to notify their agencies and their agency heads, because it is it's a violation of another portion of the DPM, the disciplinary portion of the DPM, if they fail to file. So that's a reason to notify the agency head. But for all intents and purposes, yes, they continue to serve.
We have been publishing, though, haven't we? Been publishing their names of those who have not filed. Didn't we do that? And, you know, a list of.
Yes,
yeah.
We do.
And that also can be embarrassing to the agency as well, for not following up to make sure they file.
Okay, so this just kind of break down the effort, the confidential. What's left for the confidential financial disclosure statement enforcement effort from last year. So last month we informed you we're prepared to bring enforcement action against, maybe it was a dozen last month. I would say we're down to three now.
Excellent.
Yeah. So one of the nine filers was on workers' comp. Another one filed this year's form but didn't file last year's form. So for those two, we want to give them a little more time to try to bring them into compliance, but still, I don't know where we're going to do the workers' comp person, because he has not been at the agency, 18 months?
Which one?
The workers' comp employee.
Right, he's been out since 2016 or end of 2015 on workers' comp.
It's been quite a while.
Yeah.
So we're not proposing enforcement action against that individual. So again, we're prepared to propose enforcement action against the three who haven't filed this year or last year, and you know, we'll take that up with you later in the agenda.
Okay.
So lobbyists, we recently met with an OCTO representative regarding OCTO's update to our lobbying e-filing system. And I think the important thing here is when this is expected to launch. According to OCTO, the updates to the e-filing system will be ready in November, which is approximately 2 months prior to the January filing system. So that should give us some opportunity to make sure that the system is working. And it will give us automatic updates and impose fines automatically for persons who either late file or fail to file. Non-confidential investigations, we have two to discuss with the board. First is In re Jaron Price, and this is just an update as to where the litigation is right now. Essentially, Mr. Price's brief was due on August 26th, and he requested an extension to file his brief. There's really nothing to report in that case. We're waiting for him to file his brief, and then the government will file a response. In re Kaya Henderson, again, this is a formal complaint. Currently, there are ongoing discussions with Ms. Henderson's attorney. However, at the same time, we're in the process of conducting interviews with persons who might be witnesses in the enforcement proceedings. I don't believe we are still reviewing emails in the case.
That was my question. So we have from OCTO all of the emails. Yes, we actually received the relevant emails in a prior case that we had against Ms. Henderson. So we've been reviewing those emails, and I believe we're completed. We're done.
Okay.
That concludes our public presentation today, Madam Chair.
I do want to go back to the November public meeting. Do you have recommendations for alternate dates for the meeting?
Just off the top of my head, I'd say the next Thursday.
That following Thursday.
Should be the 9th.
Yeah, it'll be the 9th.
I'll be out of town, but...
I mean, we're here, so.
Norma, what about you? November 9th. All right, let's entertain a motion to move the November public meeting to November 9th, beginning at 11 a.m.
I so move, and I'd like to speak in favor of it. I think we should be available to work with the council and talk with the council related to the code of conduct, which you all recommended long before I got there. Got here, and I think is long overdue, and so I think it's important we be available that day to do that, and then move this to November 9th.
Great. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Great. So the November public meeting will be November 9th. All right, we can move to the public comment portion of it. I believe we have Mr. Sindrum on the phone.
You do, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioners. Michael Sindrum, disabled veteran, served our country more than most. Clarification, the November meeting date you indicate has been changed from November 2nd to 9th. Will the time remain the same?
That's correct.
11 a.m.
Correct.
Okay, thank you. It's been a challenge to be able to participate. The last couple of meetings, ordinarily, Ms. Hughes, you know, would call me in advance. That hasn't happened. And to get through to you all, like I say, has been challenging. If you can help cut the chase on that so I can be, you know, privy from the start of the meeting. Also, hard copy of information. A reasonable accommodation to be sent when it's available to you all. I've heard Dropbox and other things. I certainly don't want privileged confidential information, but I do want what the public, you know, has at its disposal. I am, again, cybernetically challenged, so I would ask for the hard copy to be sent to me. My address remains 6645, 6645 Georgia Avenue Northwest,
Mr. Syndrome.
306.
Mr. Syndrome, there's no need for you to put your address out into the public record. We will.
It's in the phone book, so it's no big deal. At Washington, D.C., 20,012.
We will not mail you agenda items ahead of the meeting, and it's just not practical. We will make them available. They are posted on the doors. They are on OOG's website. So you can either come in, you can go online. I'm not sure what other accommodations we can make for you, but it's not a reasonable accommodation for us to mail you the agenda in sufficient enough time for it to go through the Postal Service and you receive it ahead of the meeting.
If I may, Madam Chair, given my medical disabilities, permanently dislocated kneecaps and whatnot, where doctor has indicated restrictive, limited walking standing. So if you're telling me to come over your way, that's exacerbating my condition and increasing my pain. May I suggest you have couriers, district couriers at your disposal. So if the mail doesn't work for you, then in the alternative, if a courier could deliver it, that would be a reasonable accommodation.
Mr. Syndrome, we can move on. Our opinion still stands.
Opinion? Your opinion? I mean, the law is to be followed by all. You all take adverse action. I mean, you can't make up the rules as we go along. You may not like it and so on, but it is the law. And a reasonable accommodation, either by mail, snail mail, or by courier. On April the 14th of this year, I wrote to Darren Sobin, two separate letters. And they were delivered by hand again on April 27th of this year. I haven't heard a word. I resubmitted to Ms. Hughes. Copies, respectively. It's been a nightmare dealing in-house with Mr. Sobin. We clarified that there's no pre-filing and injunction. But again, you all want folks to timely comply and report and so on. But if you're not doing that on your end, how can you expect anyone else to do different? So again, on April 14th of this year, I wrote to Director Sobin, right, and I've got to get a response. Written response. And I would think from April the 14th, and again, redelivered on April 27th to today's date of September the 7th is more than ample time to respond intelligibly. Has not done that. Do you like being ignored, Madam Chair, or you, Commissioner, Councilman Schwartz? I don't think so. So why am I ignored continually? You know, 10 years. This is not good.
Do you have any other matters, Mr. Syndrome?
Well, to be flippant, you know, and move on, that is a matter. And I'd like to know when I'm going to get a response from the Executive Director, Sobin. 5 days?
You know what? I will have an investigator contact you about this matter. Do you have any other matters before the board?
The letter is not directed to an investigator. Maybe it should be directed to you, but it's directed to the Executive Director. And it's incumbent upon him to reply, and or maybe you.
Darren Sobin is no longer employed with the District of Columbia. Darren Sobin is no longer the director of this board. So he will not be responding at all to your letter.
So you're telling me Mr. Sobin is no longer with the board at all?
That is correct.
So who's taking his place?
Mr. Flowers is the interim director, but again, yeah. An investigator will contact you regarding this matter. Do you have any other matters?
But what I'm asking you is who's taken Director Sobin's place?
The interim director is Brian Flowers.
Oh, Mr. Flowers, who in an earlier life was general counsel for the council, for the D.C. Council, which is clearly conflict of interest.
Okay. Thank you for your comments, Mr. Syndrome. Do we have any other public comments? Ms. Brazil.
Oh.
Okay, so we are done over here for public comment.
No problem.
Good morning. My name is Dorothy Brazil. I'm the Executive Director of DC Watch. It's been some time since I came before Bega, but I'm glad to see that an old friend is here, Brian Flowers. I have two matters I'd like to raise with the board and see if I can get some information or clarification. The first concerns the Bega website. Because I was interested in a matter which I thought might be coming up, either at this meeting or subsequent meeting, I went on the Bega's website, something I had not done for some time. And I was upset and appalled that there was no information there. I spent a considerable amount of time on just looking for one thing. I wanted to find out when the board was meeting, when its next board meeting was, and what the agenda was. I spent a good part of Monday looking on the website. And as you know, and I have a brief in front of me, the Bega website has several headings at the top. First is home, then Bega, Office of Government Ethics, then Office of Open Government, meetings, training, documents, news, ethics, training. I mention that because when you click on, at least when I did it the earlier part of this week, the heading marked meetings, there was no information. The problem was that today's meeting was not there and certainly not the agenda. I then subsequently, after several hours, called the front office here and was told that in order to see the date of the meeting and the agenda for the meeting, I had to go to the website of the Office of Open Government. And after walking me through and finding the homepage for the Office of Open Government, the way of the agenda and the date of today's meeting came up. I say all of this because I know that all of you as board members are busy people, but at some point you or your staff need to sit back and look at your website. I will detail for you other information that's not there and is certainly not user-friendly. So first and foremost, I want to put on the record that if one were diligent and tried to know and prepare for today's meeting, the meeting notice as well as the minute of the agenda for today's meeting was not there. Mr. Flowers was kind enough to send me an email later on in the day on Tuesday telling me that you were transitioning to a different format or whatever and that the information would be posted. And I have subsequently checked, and at least the agenda for today's meeting is now posted on Bega's website, but that should not have been. But if that were the only issue, I would not raise it with you. Indeed, when one clicks on the heading marked meetings, there is no information there. You cannot go on Bega's website and see any information regarding past meetings or the past minutes of meetings. The most disconcerting thing was I was looking for a particular case that had been raised with me by a Washington Post reporter several months ago. I went on the Bega's website and I could not find it. The website has been designed in a very unusual manner that is very unfriendly to people who are not in-house or members of the board. Without belaboring the point, and I'll take time later on to go through it with Mr. Flowers, in order to find a document, presumably, you need to know the date of the document. So there is a search function that says beginning date, end date that you're searching for the document. You have to put in a key word or term, and then you have to say type. When I got this call from Washington Post reporter, I knew the individual's name. I certainly entered that. Nothing came up. This morning when I did it, nothing came up. I've entered the case number. Nothing comes up. I subsequently was able to figure out a backdoor into your website, but that should not be the case. I take this time to bring it to your attention because this office should be the personification of open, transparent government. And while I can appreciate that you might be transitioning to something else, while I appreciate that you're also transitioning to a new executive director, I, as a member of the public and a longtime observer of D.C. government, want you to know that this is a serious, serious problem. And finally, during this meeting, an issue was raised about non-filers. And Ms. Schwartz asked, I assume we're publishing non-filers with regards to financial disclosures. Go try to find it on Bega's website. It's not that I couldn't find it. I don't know where it is. So I say that to say that I hope some attention resources will be devoted to improving the website. And what is past, and I'm just asking you to going forward to that, do that. My second issue, and I don't know if Mr. Flowers or anybody on the board wanted to respond to that before I go to my second issue.
Well, Ms. Brazil, we appreciate your input. If I understand you correctly, you have already been in communication with Mr. Flowers to address some of your questions and concerns.
I got in touch with him regarding the issue of today's meeting, the date and the agenda, and he addressed that. But I did not share with him my other concerns. I only sat down last night and decided that I was coming to the board meeting. And I said, what else should be there that's not there? And as I said, the classic example is the query from Ms. Schwartz about posting noncompliance. And it's not there, or at least I don't know where to find it. I'm sure the in-house staff will say, oh, you look there, 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 there. But it's not. It should be intuitive. It should not be a hunt and peck sort of situation. And I'm telling you, even when you spend 3 hours hunting and pecking and you still cannot find today's agenda on the website, there's a problem. So I will spend some time putting all of this in writing and sharing with Mr. Flowers and hopefully given some time and resources, it can be resolved. And I'd appreciate that.
Thank you.
I would just like to comment. It's good to see you, Ms.
Good
Brazil.
To see you.
And I'm so glad you're still D.C. watching. And I'm so grateful that that you brought these things to our attention. I mean, I'm the oldest one here, and I've been here about a year and a half. Some are, you know, practically brand new. And I must tell you, I have not gone on our website, and I guess that's an oversight on my, you know, I get my information, and I get it through the iPad I have to use. But I am very, very grateful that you decided to come and look at something and then found out what a debacle it appears to be. And I'm grateful that you brought it to our attention, because I think that, you know, what you said, I think, is so true, and that is, who else, if no one else in government, should have an open, findable agenda, information, but us? And I'm embarrassed that we don't have it. And I thank you for bringing it to our attention, and I expect our staff will get us in shape real quick, because I find this to be very embarrassing.
The other thing I would add to that, which you just added, and thanks for the compliment. I think it was a compliment. I certainly have my scars to
it
show.
It very much was a compliment. Even when you were on my rear, I thought you were great.
Even after the staff talks with its consultants regarding the website, I would ask that you bring in 4 or 5 people, just ordinary citizens, maybe an ANC commissioner, maybe a head of a civic organization, and task them with, well, can they find certain things? When I look at your website, I think it's too complicated. I think it's been designed by someone who's a geek. And I think that my suspicion is that staff probably has no difficulty navigating it because they know where things are, but the general public does not. So I guess what I'm saying is that even after you maybe in terms of even identifying the problem, as well as after the problems presumably have been solved, you bring, you know, 5 or 6 people in one afternoon or evening and say, look, this is our website. How can we improve it? I will tell you other agencies have done that. Office of Campaign Finance did it. That was my first item, and I don't mean to belabor your time. The second issue I have to raise is a concern I have is Ethics Day. What is it? What is its purpose? Who is the audience? Mr. Flowers, in his presentation and in a cryptic response, said no, that the individual who had a negotiated disposition with Vega would not be participating. But then I went on the website and I tried to find out programs and agendas for past ethics days to get a sense of who are you targeting, who's supposed to be coming. And you have to remember that we're already September 7th and this is just a few weeks away. So I'd like some enlightenment from the board as regards who is this program intended for. Is it D.C. government employees? Is it the public? Who is it? Because I think that goes large measure to how you design it, because I heard Mr. Flowers run off a list of agencies who are going to be participating. But should they be participating or should they be in the audience listening? I don't know. So I'd appreciate any enlightenment as regards to that particular matter. Who is Ethics Day for and what is its purpose?
Sure. To answer your question, both. They should be participating and as well as presenting at Ethics Day. It is intended for D.C. government employees. But, Mr. Flowers, if you want to address in more detail the Ethics Day framework.
This is only the second year we've done Ethics Day. Prior to that, we used to have the symposium,
mm-hmm.
and there were no ethics presentations associated with that. So last year, we decided that it would be a good idea to present all of our programs on one day and invite all the ethics counselors and D.C. employees. I think we're learning. We learned from last year. Hopefully, we'll learn something from this year's presentation and probably expand the audience. I think we do need to include ANCs, but there's some question as to what rules are going to apply to ANCs, and we're waiting on the council for that. In terms of the public certainly welcome. They're going to be open meetings, but it's not geared toward the public. It's really geared toward district employees. I don't know if Ms. Cooks wants to add anything, because she's the one who put the program together for us.
Just that we just recently finalized our agenda for the day, and we just got confirmation from those different agencies that we'll be participating. So we anticipate posting a description and also an agenda on the website this coming week.
And how are you advertising?
We are going to send out Eventbrite notices. We're also going to post in different agencies around the city, and we ask our ethics officers and ethics counselors to notify their employees. I don't think we have anything else.
I don't know what to say. I think I would just ask that you reconsider how you're going to get the word out, especially if you want the public to come. The public, by and large, is not subscribers to Eventbrite, okay? There are other ways if you really want to get the word out. This is a sore point with me in terms of D.C. government is moving more and more to assuming that everybody is tweeting and everybody is on their little devices or social media. You have staff that know how to do it. I mean, this is not rocket science. If you want the public to come, and maybe it's not something you want to have the public come to, but if you want to have the public come, I think that the process of inviting the public should not be just a throwaway of, oh, we'll just post it on this website, or we'll just put it on a Twitter account or something like that. I think some thought really needs to be given to it. And my final point concerns Ethic Day and Michael Brown. As you might have imagined, the Michael Brown situation was what I was called by the Washington Post about a few weeks ago. And this takes me again back to the website. I don't understand, and maybe you can enlighten me, why the names of individuals even those who have reached a negotiated disposition with the board, their names are redacted. But meanwhile, you read into the body of the disposition and all is revealed. I don't understand why the investigation of Michael Brown concluded in July of 2013, but the negotiated disposition was only signed in June of 2015. I don't know what your policies and procedures are, but I would like to use this as a teaching moment for me to figure out how Vega comes to its decisions, how it makes it and does its investigations or what have you. I personally don't know of an investigation or notice of violation that went for more than 2 years without some action being taken. Now, I agree that he was incarcerated, but none of the information other than the redacted copy of the negotiated disposition is even on your website. So from the board, could you just tell me whether or not, if there is a matter that has been resolved by the board, whether or not the file is available for review or FOIA request or what?
So you can make a FOIA request, okay. And the information that is not under the FOIA Act exempt from mm-hmm. public knowledge can be made available. Mm-hmm. But as a general rule, we do not post the case materials for any of our investigations after they're concluded. The redaction of the names it goes back to the statute, unless the target agrees to have his or her full name. And even then, do we unredact it?
The only thing I'm aware of that's redacted is the first name. So we have the first initial and then the last name for public dispositions. Certainly something that preceded me. And I think my understanding is that it's some attempt to not to overly publicize the punishment of the individual. But I really I'm unsure as to why we do it exactly the way that it's been done. Well, we do not redact the names for public dispositions, only the first name.
I just wanted to, can I weigh in on this? As I said, I've been here a year and a half, and I'm the grandma of the group, mm-hmm. literally and figuratively in many ways. But and then our staff has also changed. I mean, I think Mr. Flowers has been here, what, 2 years? You know, so all this preceded all of us.
Right.
But I have had, since the Michael Brown thing came up, mm-hmm. and I don't mind saying the name,
mm-hmm.
Some discussions. Like, I sat here for a year and a half and didn't know about this settlement that was made of this live, in-person, 12 presentations mm-hmm. right out of prison.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no idea until, 2 months ago? We had a briefing on Ethics Day, the new format for Ethics Day, and then I was told that, you know, the big presenter was going to be Michael Brown. I thought I'd have a heart attack. And it just coincidentally, there was a Washington Post reporter here, I think about Henderson or somebody else, but I didn't know him. It was somebody that was new to the Post, and I didn't know there was a reporter here. And I don't think any of us were aware of it at the time. But when that presentation came forward, I mean, my first thing I said was, you know, I can just see the Washington Post. What do you call it there? You know, when they do
The cartoons.
The cartoons. I can just see the Washington Post cartoons. And not even cartoons. Because I just thought it was, you know, just unfathomable, actually. I mean, I can see if somebody's been out of prison for several years, they're living life on the straight and narrow, you know, then maybe there's such a thing as I learned from my experience and I've become a much better ethical person and I want to talk about it and how being in prison is a terrible thing. I know there's, you know, discussions about this being a way for people to redeem themselves. But I don't think you do it 5 minutes after prison. And I also think you need to look at the record and the history of this individual. And so I was just appalled. and there we have regrouped. He's not going to be doing a presentation at our Ethics Day. But I did go back and talk to a staff member about why would you have done this? I mean, and we're left holding this bag, and none of us even knew about it. And so I'm hoping that the staff that does now realize what kind of embarrassment this causes, board, you know, realizes they need to discuss these things with us before they start planning these things that might be a terrible source of embarrassment for this group. And whether I'm not even talking about me personally, I'm talking about the board itself. And that's how it got publicized, is because the Post reporter happened to be sitting here, not on that issue, but on something else. And then I guess he must have decided it had enough, you know, interest. Maybe he would, you know, because I got a call from him like three or four weeks later, and he introduced himself as the person who was sitting in the room and started asking me about it. But I do think that it was, I think, done prior to our all being here, including the leader, the interim leader of our staff. So I that's not saying that it, I don't think, I would certainly not have voted for it had I been there, or even entered into such an agreement so early into somebody's leaving prison.
I just have a couple of questions. Well, first, in response to you, Ms. Schwartz, I have a copy of the negotiated disposition, and it was signed by the former chairman of the board, and the sentence just above the signature says it was approved by the board. So,
But that was in 2015.
Right. So, again, there is a certain value in terms of having the board's minutes available, because the first thing I wanted to do is, what was the discussion that preceded his signature on this? But the board minutes are not there. To the chairman, I understand the sensitivity of investigations and what is made public and what is not made public. I have a copy of the negotiated disposition, and I only have it because I knew it existed. And because when you put it in the search engine, Michael Brown or M. Brown or what, nothing comes up. Or you even put the case number, as I said, nothing comes up. There was a notice of violation that was prepared in 2013. How do you view notices of violation? Is that a document that should be posted, or you don't post notice of violation either?
We don't post any of the documents related to a case other than the negotiated disposition. Mr. Flowers, correct me if I'm wrong.
I believe NOVs are published, because they're public documents. The NOV, once it's issued.
So is it on the BEGA website?
Don't know if it's on the BEGA website. There's no reason it shouldn't be or wouldn't be released to the public, though.
So the question is, what do we proactively publish on the BEGA website, not what the public has access to if they make the request for the information. What do we post on the website?
Certainly since I've been here, NOVs have been published on the website.
Okay.
In the last 2 years.
Well, I raise this point because it would be very helpful if someone wanted to know what BEGA was doing, likely cases that were pending, to even just see the notice of violation. Now, I know I am a big enough girl to know that, you know, the notice of violation simply shows what your investigative staff have found, and it doesn't indicate what attorneys negotiate, what have you. And as I indicate that this notice of violation was filed in 2013 and the negotiated disposition is finalized in 2015, but this is a formal document, and I don't understand why, or is there a policy reason? Or maybe I should ask the bigger issue. Does BEGA have any rules? What is BEGA's own policies regarding investigations and documents made to the public? Do you have rules and procedures?
You're asking in terms of disclosure of the
yes.
documents? Well, FOIA is going to trump everything.
Absent FOIA, in terms of two steps. One, my question is it left to the staff to determine, or someone in the staff who posts to your website, or do you have some written guidelines that determine what is public and therefore goes on the web? And then there's a separate issue is what is public that can be made available if a formal FOIA request is made?
There's some guidance throughout our rules, but again, in the end, it's going to come down to FOIA and whether or not we choose to take advantage of the exemptions that are available to us. I mean, because FOIA is a discretionary statute.
So,
unless there's a mandatory withholding. We do have a mandatory withholding provision for the subjects of investigations.
Do that one more
time. The document has been removed. Unless the investigation is public, we are required to withhold the name of the subject of the investigation.
Let me, I don't mean to belabor this, but once Vega is in the process of doing an investigation, I understand the sensitive nature, what have you. But then when you issue a notice of violation and you forward it to the party and their attorneys, and it's given a case number. Now, I picked this up doing a Google search on the internet. I didn't get the notice of violation for Michael Brown from your website. So someone got a hold of this. And what is interesting is Michael Brown's name is there. His address and phone number is not. So for future reference, does Vega have written guidelines as regards what information is made public and when it is made public by posting to your website first, and number two, subject to FOIA? Or is it more or less loosey-goosey?
It's FOIA. That's what we use. And we do that on a case-by-case basis.
Posting the negotiated disposition. The negotiated disposition, is that subject to FOIA? Or only received, gotten by FOIA?
It is going to be, I think it's going to be covered by FOIA. I forget which one of those. But orders and decisions made by public bodies are required to be released.
Okay. What orders and decisions are you then posting to your website?
The ones that are made.
So this negotiated disposition for Michael Brown should be posted to your website.
It is on our website, and I've been on the website with reporters, and I've retrieved it by putting in Brown. Our search function was updated 2 or 3 months ago. 2 or 3 months earlier, you couldn't have even done that. Now, if you put in Brown, it will produce that and other negotiated dispositions involving people named Brown.
Well, I will tell you, you have to sit down with me after this meeting and show me where it is, because I could not find it. So let me make sure I leave this with this understanding. When you conclude an investigation and a notice of violation is sent to the party or to the attorney, that is not a public document. It is only retrievable if someone knows it exists and files a FOIA.
Could you repeat that, please?
Notice of violation. That is not a public document.
It is.
So do you post a notice of violation to the website?
We do.
After the meeting, I want you to show me one notice of violation you've posted to the website, just one, because it's not there. It's not there. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brazil. Do we have any other public comment? No? Okay. At this time, I will entertain a motion for us to move into the executive session to discuss ongoing confidential investigations pursuant to D.C. Official Code Section 2-57B to deliberate on decisions in which the Ethics Board will exercise quasi-judicial functions pursuant to D.C. Official Code Section 2-57B13 and personnel matters pursuant to D.C. Official Code Section 2-57B10. Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? No. All right. The time is now 12:17. We'll move into executive session.
Her stuff is still here. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
She don't get her. She's still out there.
Yeah, she's intentionally trying to make home for lunch.
Oh, yeah, it could be recording for all we know.
Probably she went to the bathroom.
It's her laptop.
Her laptop. Could be argumental, that's all.
No, we don't know if it's recording.
She was certainly looking at Ashley's
notes.
Oh, no, I'm not touching her. I wouldn't dare do that.
Any orders? We usually have them up there. Oh, of course it's up there. Well, you just put in Brown on our website, it comes up. Max Brown, Sailway Brown, Michael Brown. It doesn't come on.
Okay.
Wait.
I just passed Carol in the restroom.
Me too. That's why everyone.
The
search function is fast improving on both there.
Oh, I agree. And I routinely find negotiations at the website daily. But in terms of how user friendly it is, I sent you that email 2 days ago about the website. So I think there are some rooms for need to change our head. We have a subheading for disposition. We don't have a subheading for the OCP, and they're under something else.
Sorry.
Okay, we can go back on the public record. The time is 1:34. The board has several things to report out. The board has approved a negotiated.
Sorry. The board has approved a negotiated disposition in case number 1019-013. In addition, the board has authorized notices of violation, having determined that there is reason to believe the following individuals have violated the district code of conduct. One, Adrian Moon, case number 1630-001. Two, Rasan French, case number 1641-001. And three, Edward Ball, case number 1640-001. The next public meeting will be October the 19th at 11 a.m. Are there any questions or further comments? Oh, the board has...
I cannot miss that.
Thank you. Hearing nothing else, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.